You're listening to the Heritage Radio Network. Tonight's show is sponsored by Bao Fresh Kombucha, New York City's locally brewed, organic, and best-tasting kombucha. Bao is committed to providing New Yorkers with an alternative to the sugary sodas and teas that add calories to your diet without any nutritional benefits. Ask for Bao at your neighborhood cafes, groceries, and restaurants, or visit any gourmet garage location throughout the city to pick up a bottle. Learn more at drinkbao.com or join them on Facebook at drinkbao. Welcome to Why We Cook on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. I'm Erica Wides, your host. And hopefully you're listening live tonight to Why We Cook, although there seems to be a little bit of a technical issue, so you can listen to the show archived. Or you can always listen to our iTunes podcasts. You can subscribe, and they'll automatically be delivered to you every week. So when I was growing up in the culinary wasteland of Long Island in the early 1970s, if we wanted to go out for dinner, we had merely a handful of options in our town. A handful, like one hand. Like probably most American suburban towns of that era. There just weren't that many restaurants. People ate at home a lot more than they do now. It was the depths of the recession years, mid-early 70s. It was the energy crisis. It was the post-Vietnam, pre-Reagan slump days of the decade. And plus, moms cooked, or whoever cooked at home. People cooked at home more back then. You know, maybe you went out like once on the weekend. And if your parents were into food, as mine kind of were, there was probably some wok cooking going on. Chinese was getting big in the 70s. And maybe a smattering of foods from other places. Maybe a copy of Mastering the Art of French Cooking was floating around. You know, people were aware of what was going on in food. But I think the general suburban life tended to be fairly straightforward American. I mean, there were some early hints of the food revolution that was to come, or that was beginning to happen on the West Coast, kind of filtering its way across the country from California. And sometimes we would, actually quite often, we would drive into Manhattan to partake of cultural offerings, and that usually involved eating something cheap yet exotic. So we were exposed to that stuff. But this was an era before the really big boom in food and restaurants, you know, before the onset of the big chains like Chili's and Applebee's, places like that. But they came along more in the 80s, I think. Although I think we had a Red Lobster, but I don't think it opened until close to the 80s. So most of the restaurants were these small places. They were independently owned, run by families. And most of them were still run and still looked and felt and had food that was straight out of 1959, practically, you know, with cocktail lounges, straight out of Mad Men, and pretty focused on keeping it simple and non-exotic. I think the taste for the new and exotic in food had come home with the GIs from the war in the 40s and had made some pretty big inroads, you know, culinarily speaking in the U.S., but you know, so in our town, the restaurants were still like the old school, like meat, red meat and cocktails kind of variety, at least until, you know, the mid-late 70s. And although as I was sort of thinking about this today, I did start to remember these odd little places that popped up in town. We had this sort of hippified natural foods restaurant that had opened. And when I was little, I seemed to remember that everything was served with alfalfa sprouts on top of it. And I don't like alfalfa sprouts. You know, it was like hummus and grated carrots and stuff, which is fine. But I think it was called Shambhala Gardens. It was probably run by like the local Hare Krishnas or something. But there was this little pocket of artists and bohemians that lived in our little Republican fishing village of Port Jefferson on Long Island. And so they had this little restaurant, and somebody opened a natural food store, which actually later turned into quite the gourmet market in the 80s. And, you know, there's an alternative clothing store that sold over-dyed army fatigues, things that eventually became staples of my junior high school wardrobe. But anyway, I'm getting too far ahead of my time. That's nearing into the 80s. What I want to talk about is this sort of early mid 70s, 73, 74. And what I really want to talk about is a place that was there called the Elk Hotel and Restaurant. I think at some point it actually was a hotel, but I'm not sure if by then it had any hotel rooms. I don't know. It all seemed a little mysterious to me. But so as I said, we lived in this little tiny, what was a little tiny town, Port Jefferson, on the North Shore of Long Island. It was a very sleepy, tiny place when we moved out there in the 60s. It had, I guess, originally been a whaling town and a big shipbuilding town, too. And then when whaling ceased and ships were not built locally but out of wood anymore, it was more of a fishing village. And it still kind of was a fishing village back then, you know, although the fishing industry on Long Island started a long, steep decline around then and it's pretty much petered out since then. But it was still kind of a fishing village at the time. Although in the 80s, a local developer guy basically bought up the whole town and then remade it to look like a colonial fishing village. He's like tore everything down and then rebuilt it to make it look old. So that tourists could come over on day trips from Connecticut, since the ferry to Bridgeport took off from there. And, you know, so people could come over and walk around the faux fishing village and buy garbage and get in the way. But then that developer went to jail for some kind of fraud when I was in high school. So that kind of sounds like the 80s, doesn't it? Anyway, so out went the old docks and the lobster boats and the lobstermen and the old restaurants with lounges and tap rooms. And in came the ice cream stands and the nautical-themed tchotchka stores and the takeout fried seafood place where I worked one summer, where everything came in boxes frozen and pre-breaded just to be thrown in the fryer. And I don't think anything came from anywhere near Port Jeff Harbor. I think it all probably came from the Philippines or somewhere. And, of course, that was the end of the era of the Elk Hotel and Restaurant. Too dated, I suppose, too old-fashioned, not what people were looking for in the 80s. You know, like I said, it was straight out of Mad Men. It had a bar room. It had a tap room. It had, like, a fancy garden-themed dining room for the ladies. And it had this one room that I like to call the map room when I was little because it was decorated with nautical charts and fishing nets and all sorts of ephemera related to the sea. And it was dark and clubby and, you know, upholstered and smelled like cigarettes and fish and cocktail sauce. And I loved it. And when we moved out there in 1968, it was one of probably only three or four places in the whole town that were considered decent to eat at. So we went. And it seems like in my memory, of course, you know, 30-something years later, that we went there all the time. But we probably went, like, maybe, I don't know, a couple times a month or something. In my mind, we were there every night, but I'm sure we were not. I mean, we didn't have any money. My father was a teacher. We did not have the money. But I guess we went, you know, once in a while. I think they had some kind of dinner special that was a really good deal. And that's why we went. And they were really nice about little kids coming in. And they would take one dinner special and split it in half. And that's what my sister and I would eat. They would split a dinner entree. And we always shared that. And then we always had chiffon pies for dessert. When's the last time you ate a chiffon pie or even heard of the term chiffon pie? What is a chiffon pie? Maybe next week's show can be all about chiffon pies. Anyway, I'm getting off the point again. What I really want to get to, and it seems to always take me an entire segment to get to what I really want to talk to, is what my parents ate when we went to the Elk Hotel for dinner. In my memory, it seems, I remember, that they always ordered the same thing, which was fried soft-shell crabs on toast. That's how they were served, on toast. Or at least that's what they ate when we went there in the soft-shell season, not in the winter, which is now. Now, did those soft-shell crabs come right from Port Jeff Harbor? Possibly. I would say yes, most likely. Back then, there were still crab and lobstermen working the harbor. And you could actually just buy stuff from them, shellfish, right off their boats. And we often did that. And I like to think that the Elk Hotel was buying local crab. I'm just going to say yes, it was. And I'm going to live in happy denial that yes, it was local softshell crab that they were cooking and putting on toast. Now, as a child, I ate a lot of things. I wasn't really picky. I was fairly adventurous. I ate just about anything, except a couple things. I wouldn't eat raw tomatoes, I wouldn't eat yogurt, and I wouldn't eat mustard. All of which I love today, but it, you know, some, you learn to love things. Just goes to show you that you should never give up on your kids. If they say they don't like something, you need to keep trying to get them to like it. Anyway, those fried softshell crabs, which I think to a more tentative eater would be seen as a horrific creature, like a giant fried bug. But to me, they were juicy and they were crisp and crabby, crabalicious. And I don't think it even dawned on me what the name really implied, that what I was actually eating, that they were still in their shell. I just knew that at some point I would get a bite of that softshell crab on toast from my mom, and I loved them. And now I'm wondering why my sister and I always had to order the roast chicken, which was really good, and it came with stuffing and gravy. It was like very old-fashioned and really good. But how come they got to eat the crabs and we always had to eat the chicken? I don't understand. Why no crabs for the kids? And how come we never ate softshell crabs at home? We ate lobster at home. We'd buy them from the guy, from the lobster boat guy down on the dock many summer weekends. We fished all the time. We ate so much bluefish out of Long Island Sound that I am sure that I have PCB poisoning at this point in my life. But why not the softshell crabs at home? I was thinking that maybe it's because I had kosher grandparents, and the kosher grandparents, they knew about the lobsters, and I think they just looked the other way. They just pretended. But I think maybe eating whole crabs inside of their shell may have pushed them right over the edge. Although they didn't live with us, so I don't know how they would ever find out, but I have to do a little bit of probing into my family history to find out more about this. So we're going to take a little quick break here. When we come back, more about softshell crabs.
Pick my nipple, champagne and ripple. Shoppers go cripple.
Sales go triple.
We drop lobotomy beats. Evaporated meats in high-tech streets. We go solo. Dance floors and talk shows. Hot dogs, no-dos. Hot sex and back rows.
I'm on a man that makes you scream. Beautiful and green on the fantasy. Chichi real good. Fancy jeans, Hollywood freaks from the Hollywood scene.
You're listening to the Heritage Radio Network. Tonight's show is sponsored by Bao Fresh Kombucha, New York City's locally brewed, organic, and best-tasting kombucha. Learn more at drinkbao.com or join them on Facebook at drinkbao. Welcome back to Why We Cook on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. I'm Erica Wides, your host. I'm a chef instructor at the Institute of Culinary Education in Manhattan. By the way, forgot to mention that in the first segment. So I'm talking tonight about softshell crabs because they're in season now. The season has begun, and I would say that they are probably in the top five favorite list of foods in my life. If I had to pick five foods to eat for the rest of my life, softshell crabs would definitely be way up there on the list. And I was talking in the first segment about this restaurant in the town where I grew up, very old-fashioned, very Mad Men era, that used to serve them whole deep-fried softshell crabs on toast as a dinner entree. And my parents would always eat those, and my sister and I never got to eat those, and I always loved them. So I'm wondering why we never got to eat them and why we never ate them at home. But anyway, so it is softshell crab season, and that's what I want to talk about, is how you can go out and get them and take them home, and you can cook them and eat them at home. Now, the ones that we used to eat at the Elk Hotel were deep fried. And granted, frying is a messy proposition, but to deep fry a crab, you only need a couple inches of oil. You don't need a big, huge pot. And they don't actually have to be fried at all. You could pan fry them. You could saute them. I'll get to that a little bit later in the show. But you could grill them. You can do a lot of different things to them. The ones at the Elk Hotel were also served on toast. And that to me is like a real relic of that era. E-R-A. So why the toast? Why couldn't that chef just throw them on a plate. What was that squishy toasted white bread actually there for? I guess it was sort of like a mop to soak up the juice. I sort of remember a lot of things being served on toast back then. It's kind of very British. They like to serve things on toast, too. You don't see anything served on toast anymore. I bet when Don Draper goes out for soft-shell crabs, he eats them on toast when he's on business lunches from Sterling Cooper. Although, if you're a fan of Mad Men, you know there is no more Sterling Cooper. He doesn't work there anymore. All right, anyway, so those crabs to me are like my Madeleines. They're Proustian for me. And I can still taste them, and I can still smell the smell of that room in that hotel restaurant. And I, like I said, still count them as probably number one in my top five foods, or top five proteins at least. And they're in season right now. They're in season late May through September, let's say. And if you look around, you can find them for a couple dollars each, but you'll also find them for like $6 a piece. So don't get ripped off. Be a smart shopper. Look around. And if you're wondering what they are, what is a soft-shell crab, you may ask. Now, I know that my listeners are a pretty sophisticated bunch when it comes to food, and I doubt that a single one of you doesn't know, but just in case there's someone out there who doesn't, soft-shell crabs are blue crabs, East Coast blue crabs, that have just molted. And molting is what happens when a crustacean outgrows its shell. Lobsters, crabs, shrimp, they can't grow their shells bigger. So when they need to expand, they lose their shell. That's called molting, and the shell falls off. And then they secrete this very, very thin, papery new shell that over the course of a few days will thicken and harden and solidify into their new hard shell, their exoskeleton. But in those few precious hours between molting and their shell hardening up, we clever humans figured out that we could snag them from the sea at that point, roll them in flour or some other starchy coating, fry them, and eat them whole, shell and all. Just eat them whole. That's why we're at the top of the food chain, because we figured that out, and they didn't. So the shells are still really, really soft, and they're fully edible, and they get really crispy in the pan. They crisp up, and you get a good dose of calcium while you're at it from eating them. And then you get this luscious mouthful of juicy, crabby crab meat, and then a naturally crisp shell of fried shell. And you also eat their guts along with it. You eat whatever's inside of them, too. And that just adds to the fun, because that stuff tends to squirt out when you bite down into them, and leaving you covered in crabby, delicious goodness. So commercially, the crabs are caught all over the eastern seaboard. And to make the timing, to make it work for commercial fishermen, what they do is they catch all the crabs before they molt, and they put them in big pens, and then they just wait for them to molt. And then as soon as they molt, they pluck them out and sell those off. So they're constantly in that cycle. And when you buy them, you want to make sure that they're alive. You always want to purchase live shellfish, because all shellfish, as soon as it starts to die, it starts to decay. It's not like chicken or meat or something where you don't want to buy it live. You want to buy it dead. It starts to decay if you buy it dead. There are enzymes inside the heads and bodies of the shellfish that will immediately start to break down the proteins at the time of death. And that's why when you buy lobsters, clams, oysters, mussels, they're always sold alive, because you don't want them to start to decay. And you're saying, but chef, when I buy shrimp, they're dead. Yes, and that's because the heads have been taken off, and it's inside the head where those enzymes live. So chop off the head, then you're fine. You can freeze them or whatever. So you want to buy these soft shell crabs alive, and they should be packaged on top of wet seaweed or wet straw or wrapped in wet newspaper. They have to stay damp. And then you can put them in the fridge, and they'll stay there for a good couple of days. But the shells will start to toughen up, so you want to eat them as soon as possible. Also, don't put them in a plastic bag and seal it up, because they'll suffocate. So you want to get them, put them in the fridge, sooner the better. Cook them. And so today I was doing a little research on the show, and I checked seafoodwatch.org, which is from the Monterey Bay Aquarium website. They keep this constantly updated chart of what fish is okay to eat and what fish isn't, because it changes all the time, and I don't want to be telling you to go out and eat something that's on the brink of extinction. So they say that softshell crabs are a good alternative. That's like their second best rating, good alternative, as opposed to best choice, as opposed to avoid. They say that the populations of softshell crabs are good, but not as strong as they used to be because of pollution. And a lot of that pollution is coming into the Chesapeake Bay from the poultry industry and farming also, not so good. But what they did say was that there's not a lot of bycatch with crabbing, and that's good. Bycatch is what happens when fish are caught in nets, and there's all kinds of other stuff caught with them, and it just dies along the process, like sharks. Sharks are bycatch of tuna fishing, and the shark population is like plummeting fast, not just because of bycatch, but also because of the idiotic desire to eat shark fin soup in Asia, which is seen as a status symbol if you can afford it, and is leading to sharks basically dying. And if sharks die, that's a big problem because they're the top of the food chain. But anyway, we're not talking about sharks today. So according to Seafood Watch, it's okay to eat those crabs. So you can do it. It's okay. Try to avoid the farmed ones, though. You can get them. Don't get the frozen ones from Asia. They're not the right kind of species of crab. They're okay. They're not as good. Buy, you know, get local, eat them in season. They also said they do contain some mercury and some lead, but considering how short the season is and how many you'll probably eat over the course of a season, you'll be okay. I'm still going to eat them. I'm not eating them every day, although I would if I could. We have to take another quick break. When we get back, we're going to talk about how to actually cook them. We'll be right back.
Hollywood freaks from the Hollywood scene.
Got you real good if you want the peace. Why do people know I'm that type of freak?
They wanna feel the house. They wanna feel the house.
Love is yours, cop. Something tells me you wanna go home. Champagne bottles, custom clothes you own. Calling up from special area codes. Hollywood nubs with the Hollywood phones.
I got nothing to do, nowhere to go.
You're listening to the Heritage Radio Network. Tonight's show is sponsored by Bao Fresh Kombucha, New York City's locally brewed, organic, and best-tasting kombucha. Learn more at drinkbao.com or join them on Facebook at drinkbao. Last week's show, all about kombucha. If you don't know what we're talking about, go to iTunes, find the show, listen to it. All right, welcome back to Why We Cook on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. I'm Erica Wise, your host, and we're talking about softshell crabs, one of my top five favorite foods on the planet. So, you're going to buy those softshell crabs. We talked about buying them in the last segment. Look for ones that are alive. Make sure they're still alive. You'll know they'll be wiggling their little fins, their little whatever they're called, feet. What are they called on crabs? Anyway, their eyes will be moving around. And when you're ready to cook them, there's a couple of things that you need to do to get them ready for the pan. Remember that you want them to be alive when you buy them. But unlike lobster, which you kind of want to keep alive even as you're starting the cooking, although you don't have to, softshell crabs require a couple of little preparatory steps, some preparation. The first thing you need to do is you need to get a pair of scissors or a very sharp knife, and you have to cut off their face. Yes, really. You have to cut off their face because, I don't know why, because you don't want to eat their face, and because I think their eyes have a lot of moisture and might pop in the pan and burn you. I really don't know why you take off the face, but you do. So you just cut right below the eyes, snip, take off the face. Remember that these guys have very primitive nervous systems. We all suffer pain in our lives at some point. Okay, so you cut off the face. Then you have to remove the gills because they're not edible. So on the top shell, the nicely colored one, not underneath, but the top, if you sort of pull up on either side of the shell, almost like a pair of wings, you'll see under that shell flap these kind of feathery, translucent white things. Those are the gills. Pull those out. You don't even need a knife. They just pull, or you can use your scissors. Take them out. They're inedible. They're not poisonous. They're just inedible. So, you know, it'd be like trying to eat, like, the fish bones. Okay, then flip the crab over, And this is where you get the bonus lesson in biology and anatomy that comes along with preparing soft-shell crabs for eating. When you turn the crab over, there's something on it that's called its apron. And it's really kind of like its tail. It's like the tail has folded itself under and is tucked under the crab. And it's a piece of shell that you'll see it when you turn it over. It's sort of tucked into like a little crevice right down the middle of the shell. And this is where you get your anatomy and biology lesson. This is how you can tell if the crab is male or female. If the crab is male, the apron shell is long and skinny and pointy and looks like the Washington Monument. And if the crab is female, the apron is shorter and rounder and pointed on top and looks like the Capitol building. So you also get a lesson in American government at the same time. Regardless of which building it represents, you want to take that off too because it's not edible. It's too hard. I know we're eating the whole shell, but that part of the shell is too crunchy and too hard. So pull off the apron, just give it a little twist, boing, comes right off. Now you're ready to cook. Now you have to decide how you're going to approach these crabs. Do you want them dredged, which means just coated in flour or starch? Do you want them maybe breaded, which means like a flour, egg, breadcrumb situation, standard breading? Do you want them battered? Do you want to dip them in a batter? Do you want to tempura them? Do you want to just very lightly dust them and saute them? What do you want to do? I'm personally a fan of just letting the crabs freak flag fly and letting the flavor shine through. So I don't think breading them or battering them is really the way to go, unless you're very, very good at tempura, in which case you'd get a really nice light coating. I would say very lightly dust them in flour or cornstarch and pan fry or saute. I think they taste better that way. So I do acknowledge that at the Elk Hotel, where the crabs of my Proustian childhood were served, they were battered and deep fried and, of course, served on toast. And they were great. But I am more a fan of just, let's just taste the crab. So I like to just dust them really lightly with a little cornstarch or flour. So just dip them in there and then just smack that crab around until it's just barely coated. Heat up a pan with some olive oil, or clarified butter would be really good, or bacon fat would be really, really good, or you could use vegetable oil. And then drop the crab in the pan. Now, as soon as it hits the pan, run. Run away from the stove, like 10 feet away, because that crab is full of moisture and sometimes things explode. You get these really loud popping sounds. Sometimes the legs pop. It can get a little ugly. It can get a little violent and a little painful because you can get splattered. So drop the crab in the pan and then take a hike. Come back after the crackling stops. Turn it over. Do the same thing. Cook them until they turn pink. You know how when you buy a lobster and it's alive, it's sort of bluish green, but then you cook it and it turns red? It's the same thing with a crab. They're blue crabs, but when you cook them, they turn pink. Well, they turn red, really. So cook them until they're red and nice and crispy and golden brown. There's no real way to tell that they're done other than cook them until they're just nice and red all over and really crispy. And then I think that these should be served with something that is acidic, but also something that's a little bit creamy, sort of like tartar sauce. You know, tartar sauce has that mayo base, so it's kind of rich, but then it also has little bits of chopped up cornichon or pickles in it, so it's acidic. That's the idea. But I like to serve them with something a little more elaborate. So I would serve these crabs maybe with like a sauce that's sort of like gazpacho. So make like a thick tomato-y, gazpacho-y type sauce. Maybe put some watermelon in it, something like that. A lot of herbs, make sure it's really limey. But then I think you also need some fat. Even though the crab meat itself is actually pretty rich and sweet, I think a little bit of an addition of something creamy and rich in there is going to kind of tie the whole dish together. So if I were doing this, I would do maybe that tomato, watermelon, gazpacho sauce, but then I'd make like a nice chili mayo, and I'd put a little blob of that on top. You kind of want the acid to bring out the sweetness of the crab, and then you want the fat because you just do, because fat tastes really good and helps to tie everything together. You could also, of course, make a sandwich, and often you see soft-shell crab sandwiches served on menus this time of the year, which would be like the updated Elk Hotel version. I would just use better bread than the toasted white sandwich bread of our collective childhoods. But that's up to you. Maybe a nice grilled slice of sourdough or ciabatta, something like that. The bread will act as a little bed to catch all the crabby juices that the crab will exude once it's cooked. So I urge you to go out and get yourself some soft-shell crabs and cook them, or at least go order a few in a restaurant. Tis the season for crabby goodness, and what better time to eat them than now. So we're just about out of time. Thank you for listening to Why We Cook this week, and thanks to Nat and Jack in the control tower. And we will see you right here next Tuesday night at 6:30.